To be Jedi is to face the truth and choose. The takeaway for December 15th, 2017 is in.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to be with you on this Friday. It's Star Wars weekend. They come out every December these days. Thanks, Disney, but we are excited, just like geeks in good standing everywhere across this galaxy. Rafer Guzman has seen The Last Jedi. He's here. He'll be with us at the end of the hour with his review. And no spoilers, I promise. We put out the call to you for your favorite moments and quotes from the Star Wars universe. You guys are amazing.
Do or do not. There is no try.
You came in that thing? You're braver than I thought.
Bring me the passengers. I want them alive.
If you only knew the power of the dark side.
Okay, we were seriously impressed with these, so we're going to have a lot of your voices with favorite moments all throughout the show. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. But for now, let me take your head out of the Galactic Senate. Sorry, that's the only reference to Episode 1 you're going to hear today. Out of the Galactic Senate and into the Senate of the United States. Because congressional Republicans are forging ahead. They're trying today to roll out a final version of their tax bill. The plan on Capitol Hill is to vote it all out by next week so President Trump can sign it by Christmas. House Speaker Paul Ryan urged people to focus on the finish line.
The results are going to be what sells this bill, not the confusion before it passes.
What confusion does Paul Ryan mean there? Well, the votes, of course. Does the Senate have them? Vice President Mike Pence canceled an overseas trip for next week to stay in Washington in case Mitch McConnell needs him to break a 50-50 tie. And for good reason. As late as last night, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, threatened to vote no on this tax bill unless the GOP expands the child tax credit. Let's take a look now at what the child tax credit is and how this tax bill could look for working families if Marco Rubio gets his way. Chai Ching Wong is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
The signature provision in the bill for working families is a child tax credit increase. But at the moment, the Senate bill leaves 26 million children and working families to not fully benefit from that increase. And 10 million of those families would get just $75 or less. So that's millions of working and middle-class families getting little or nothing. And Senator Rubio has a proposal that would give those children somewhat less inadequate child tax credit increases.
Now, what does Marco Rubio want? How does it work?
So he would more fully include those 26 million children in working families by allowing lots of parents who work really hard for low pay but have incomes too low to owe much federal income tax to benefit more from the child tax credit increase. At the moment, the Senate bill only very slightly increases the amount of child tax credit that can be received as a refund by people that have incomes too low to owe much federal income tax, even though they pay payroll taxes and lots of other state and federal taxes.
So you just said something important, I think. You said the amount that's refundable. There's a difference between a tax credit and a refundable tax credit. Why is the refundable part so important?
So again, the way that the tax code is designed is that if you have very low earnings, those earnings are not subject to a lot of federal income tax so as not to tax people who are very low paid into or deeper into poverty. And that's an explicit decision in the tax code. Now, that means, though, that if there's a tax credit for something like helping to offset the cost of raising children, if you don't have much federal tax liability to use that credit against, you can only benefit from the credit if you can receive it as a refund at the end of the year.
Right. And if a tax credit like that is fully refundable, let's say $1,000 per child, that would mean you could get a check for close to $1,000, or at least your refund could be $1,000 more.
That's exactly right. And the way that the child tax credit is currently designed is that it's not fully refundable. The part that you can receive as a refund is limited to 15% of your earnings over $3,000. So a family has to be working to receive the child tax credit, and they also have to have earnings above $3,000, and then every dollar above that, they earn a little bit of child tax credit.
So if Marco Rubio gets his way here in the final bill, and it looks like Republicans are going to need his vote, he's using some leverage, what would the child tax credit look like in the final analysis? How much would it help?
So his proposal would say that all of a low-income family's earnings would count towards earning the child tax credit. So they would be able to earn the child tax credit at the rate of 15.3%, which is the same as the payroll tax rate, from the first dollar of their earnings. And that doesn't just help working families that have incomes below $3,000. It helps a lot of families with incomes above that because they can reach the maximum credit faster.
And so how much of a help for the tens of millions of people that you described at the beginning, Chai-Ching? How far does this go if Marco Rubio gets his way to have a significant part of this tax bill really be a benefit for working families?
So it's the difference between a $75 increase in the child tax credit for a single mother working full-time at minimum wage and something more like a few hundred dollars. So it goes from a token benefit to something that's a little bit more meaningful for each of those families.
And how much would it add to the cost of the bill?
Adopting Marco Rubio and Senator Lee's proposal would cost about $87 billion. And that is about the same amount that Republicans are considering putting towards a lower tax rate for the top 1% of people at the moment.
And is the math as simple as that? Is Marco Rubio saying, take $87 billion from the tippy top and let's use it for the child tax credit for working families? Is it that simple?
Absolutely. And he, earlier in the process, said that the corporate rate cut in the bill, which is a very deep corporate rate cut from 35% to 20%, should be made slightly less deep. It should go to 20.9% instead of all the way to 20%. And that money could also be used to increase the child tax credit for working families.
But Chai-Ching, what's going on in the Senate that only at the last minute, only at the 11th hour, right before the final bill is set to pass, it takes a pretty conservative Republican like Marco Rubio to pop up and say, no, let's shift this $87 billion to working families. What's going on in the Senate?
So this is a really important point. I think it's been absolutely remarkable that all the way through, even from the president's inaugural speech, that the rhetoric has been about the working class and working families. He said, the president, every decision on taxes would be made to benefit American workers and American families. And these families have been pretty much ignored in the crafting of the bill so far. Other senators used their leverage earlier on in the process. For example, Senator Ron Johnson used the leverage of his vote to achieve higher tax cuts for wealthy business owners earlier in the process. And it's only now at this point we're looking at moving around a little bit of money in a bill that costs $1.5 trillion overall and moves around trillions of dollars. We're only now starting to think about those working and middle class families.
So, Chai-Ching, before we let you go, in the final analysis, if Marco Rubio wins his leverage fight here, if he gets the increase in the child tax credit and this bill passes, can working families, low-income families look at the tax reform tax cut bill and finally think, yeah, there's a lot in here for me?
No, I think this would make it marginally less harmful. Unfortunately, there would be still millions of low and moderate income families that would face tax increases. The bill repeals a core Affordable Care Act provision that would cause premium increases in individual markets. And again, that very strong signal that this is step one of a two-step agenda, with the second step being deep cuts to programs that benefit children and families across the population. So I think what we're talking about now is making a really bad bill somewhat less bad for millions of families.
Chai-Ching Huang with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
We've been looking back all this week to look at the choices and the fights that made the American healthcare system what it is today. And that journey takes us back to the early 90s today, nearly two decades before Barack Obama and the Affordable Care Act ever came to be. As WNYC's Christopher Johnson reports, the story of Bill Clinton's health reform effort doesn't start in Arkansas, where he was governor, or on Capitol Hill. It doesn't even start with Bill Clinton.
It begins in a tiny twin-engine propeller plane in the skies over a wealthy Philadelphia suburb. It's the spring of 1991, and U.S. Senator John Hines is flying into the city for a meeting at the Enquirer. Hines's pilots are on their approach when they run into landing gear trouble. A nearby helicopter flies in, tries to help, But things only get worse, way worse.
So let us recap what happened today. U.S. Senator John Hines was among seven people killed early this afternoon in Lower Merion Township. Hines's plane crashed with a Sun Company helicopter over the grounds of the Merion Elementary School on Bowman Avenue. The plane was
It was a tragedy for Lower Merion. Two schoolgirls were killed on the playground as burning fuel and debris rained from the sky. As for Hines, the 52-year-old senator's death meant the loss of Pennsylvania royalty.
John Hines was somebody I respected and knew relatively well. I mean, he's a very popular Republican senator.
Harris Wolford was the state's labor secretary. He was appointed to hold Hines' vacant seat until the special election in just 6 months. He ran for the office, but his opponent, Dick Thornburg, was hammering him in the polls. Wolford was hanging on by the thinnest of threads when he gets this tip that would change the whole game. Definitely for him, and maybe for the rest of the country, too.
I went to pick up several thousand dollars to our campaign from the ophthalmologists of Philadelphia. And then he said, I want to give you the most effective thing that I've ever had in terms of political interest.
The doctor told Wolford that when he gives talks, he likes to whip out his copy of the U.S. Constitution. He then points to the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right to an attorney.
And then he said, isn't it even more important that if you're sick in America, that you should have a right to a doctor? And I loved it as an idea.
That's when Wolford decided to do something really unusual. In his speeches, in his campaign agenda, and in ads like this one, he put health care right at the center of his platform.
I've been talking about national health insurance and about a tax cut for the middle class. Electing Dick Thornburg would send a signal that you want business as usual, that you don't want basic changes like national health insurance.
And it worked. Wolford won, and health care helped get him there.
We were 40-some points behind in the polls when we began, and that idea of universal health care just moved. The media all over the country was paying attention to it.
I do think it was the Harris-Wofford campaign in Pennsylvania arguing that every American should have access to health insurance. That suddenly showed that it had political legs.
Historian Theda Scotchpahl is the author of Boomerang: Healthcare Reform and the Turn Against Government. Scotchpahl notes that Wolford's successful campaign comes just as Bill Clinton is making his run for the White House.
Okay, so now we need to think about what was happening in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
That's Paul Starr, one of President Clinton's senior health policy advisors during the first campaign.
We had double-digit inflation in healthcare back then. Many people were facing very sharp increases in their health insurance premiums and their other health care costs. And public opinion polls showed that overwhelming numbers of Americans thought there was something radically wrong with the health care system and it needed fundamental change.
And this is how the fire that Harris Wolford started in Pennsylvania worked its way up to the White House, becoming part of newly elected President Bill Clinton's national agenda.
But all of our efforts to strengthen the economy will fail.
The Clinton White House believed that for the first time in nearly two decades, there was a real chance to reshape health care. In his first State of the Union speech, the president makes this appeal.
I feel so strongly about this. All of our efforts to strengthen the economy will fail unless we also take this year, not next year, not 5 years from now, but this year, bold steps to reform our health care system.
It didn't take long for things to start falling apart. First with the health care task force the president created, with First Lady Hillary Clinton in charge. This was a brain trust of cabinet members, senior officials, and healthcare professionals who would help develop his reform plan. By most counts, then and now, the task force was a mess. It was accused of being bloated and secretive and was even slapped with lawsuits concerning Hillary's leadership. The president dissolved it after 6 months. But the damage was done. President Clinton was already being condemned for drafting reform without clear plans to involve lawmakers. Later that year, interest groups that were opposed to reform began taking shots at Clinton's plan.
This was covered under our old plan.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it?
This now famous TV ad campaign called Harry and Louise is set in the future. Clinton's health plan is now law, and it's got the couple totally confused and frustrated.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
They choose.
We lose.
But the president pressed on. In September 1993, he went before a joint session of Congress and continued to make his case. No president had pushed for reform like this since the 1970s.
At long last, after decades of false starts, we must make this our most urgent priority.
The president laid out a six-part solution. He promised simplicity and improved quality in care. He told Americans they could keep their doctors if they wanted to. And at the heart of his message was this idea of security. Everybody, every single person in the U.S. would be covered. To drive his point home, the president waved before Congress a prop, a red, white, and blue health security card.
This health care security card will offer this package of benefits in a way that can never be taken away.
Here's the thing about that card. Clinton advisor Paul Starr says it ended up being kind of an omen. Starr watched the whole speech from the gallery. When the president held that card up, Starr got an idea.
That evening after the speech, I had one of the cards that had been made up. And at the White House, I asked him to sign it. And he did. He did sign it. But he was in a rush, and he signed it upside down. So I later thought, oh, that was a perfect symbol of what had happened.
For Starr, that gaffe foretold how all the support they'd hoped for on Capitol Hill, from business leaders and from the American people, how all of that would get turned on its head. There are lots of reasons why the Health Security Act failed. The economy actually started to improve. Americans were worrying less about healthcare costs and more about crime. At the same time, Starr says, the Whitewater scandal that broke out in early 1994 also did some serious damage. A Wall Street Journal NBC poll showed that attaching the president's name to what was otherwise a relatively popular reform plan sank the approval rating by as many as 40 points.
And I think the lack of trust of the president became a major factor in the outcome of the whole healthcare debate. To bring about any kind of major reform in the United States, the public has to trust the president and members of Congress. And that atmosphere, heightened distrust, undermined the possibilities for reaching any kind of bipartisan deal.
Historian Theda Scotch-Paul puts some of the blame on the way the White House conducted the business of reform almost from day one.
They ended up producing a more than 1,000-page bill. They tried to work out compromises between business, insurance companies, healthcare providers, unions, all the big stakeholders in advance of putting it into Congress. It was a very complex plan worked out by a large negotiation in secret.
The president's reform bill officially died at the end of the summer. As for major sweeping health care reform, no president would dare try it again for another 15 years, this time under President Obama.
You see, one of the things that happens in politics, as in war, people always try to learn from the last battle. The Obama administration itself took a lesson. They were full of people who had been there for the failure of the Clinton plan. They learned that coming up with a blueprint outside of Congress that you then tried to get Congress to adopt was a mistake.
As for Harris Walford, looking back, he says it never occurred to him 26 years ago that, of all things, health care would be the thing to save his campaign and become the stuff of a massive reform effort that still touches us today.
It was a wonderful feeling about the American system that it can be moved so fast. An idea that its time had come was catching fire.
Now the question is, will the fire continue to blaze or just go out? For The Takeaway, I'm Christopher Johnson.
Our thanks to WNYC's Christopher Johnson and Mary Harris for reporting these stories for us this week. If you missed any of the pieces in our series, Your Healthcare, What Happened? Check them out at the website at thetakeaway.org/healthcare. go now across the globe, to India. Society in India has been grappling with rape and the stigma around it for years. But it wasn't until recently that the shroud of silence really started to lift. Takeaway producer Alexander Boti brings us a conversation now with one researcher who's taking a novel approach to understanding the ongoing problem of rape and assault in India. She says dealing with stigma is critical to ending that violence.
Saturday marks 5 years since the day six men gang-raped and murdered a 23-year-old student named Jyoti Singh Pandey on a bus in New Delhi. Her brutal assault and death galvanized a nation.
It brought almost all Indians to the streets demanding for women's safety. And that was quite compelling for myself as someone who was born and brought up in New Delhi.
That's Madhumita Pandey. She's a researcher and doctoral candidate in the Department of Criminology at Anglia Ruskin University.
It brought up all the pent-up anger that we had. These debates, they were not really happening in India. It's almost as if collective conscious of a country, we all woke up at the same time.
That might sound familiar. Many people have described a similar feeling in the U.S. right now as we address sexual assault and harassment head-on. In India, Jyoti Singh Pandey's case did contribute to some legal changes, like stronger sentencing laws and so-called fast-track courts designed for sexual assault prosecutions. But Madhumita says equally important is that the case was a first step in tearing down persistent myths about rape in the country.
So this young student, she represented the aspirations of many young modern women. This was a case that happened in the capital city. So, you know, in this metropolitan urban city, it wasn't very late in the night. She was returning from a posh area in New Delhi where she had gone to watch a movie with a friend. So she was accompanied by a male friend. She wasn't alone. You know, as far as rape myths go, for instance, she wasn't wearing anything provocative. When the details of this case, they came through, a lot of people realized that, we need to stop sort of believing these existing stereotypes. And we really need to ask, why is it that women in India are so vulnerable to such crimes?
As a researcher, Madhumita devised a way to get at that answer. Look to the perpetrators. She embarked on a project to interview more than 100 convicted rapists in New Delhi.
I told myself that, look, I'm not there to find out if their story is true or not, or if they're actually guilty of committing this crime or not, because that has already been done by the justice system. To me, these are already men who are convicted of rape. My job is to only understand what they make of this crime that they committed, how they speak of their victims, and what it is that they can tell me about their own lives before they committed this crime.
She spent hundreds of hours with these men face to face. And what she began to find was surprising.
As I started speaking to them and as I realized that they were starting to get comfortable with me and talk about their life with me, I was just able to talk to them on a very human level. And for some of the interviews, in fact, I came out almost feeling, you know, bad for these men. Most of them spoke to me about the hardships that they faced growing up, you know, the kind of work their parents had to do, how little minimum wages. I mean, some of them said that their parents didn't even make 100 rupees, which, you know, is a while back, it was less than a pound a day. So, you know, surviving on that, not having access to education, witnessing violence within their own surroundings, then leaving the house at a very young age, you know, migration, moving for better work opportunities at a young age to cities and urban areas. So I felt like, you know, they too had their own tale of struggle. And I could relate to that, you know, because these are, on a macro level, social issues that a developing country like India is battling.
Rape is also an issue the country continues to battle daily. The National Crime Records Bureau of India reported nearly 39,000 rapes, or 106 rapes each day, in 2016. But that likely falls far short of the actual numbers, as many victims feel pressured to keep quiet or are blamed themselves. Madhumita heard this again and again from the convicted rapists.
The easiest thing for men convicted of rape is to blame their victim, whether it is to say that she asked for it. She did not really give me any signals that indicated that she wanted me to stop. Most of all, the sense that I gathered from these interviews was that they really didn't understand what consent meant. when we do not have people openly talking about sex education, sex in general, how do you explain young children what consent is, how to really tell someone that no means no, and, you know, for girls to say that and for boys to understand that.
The experience of growing up in India and not talking about things like sex and consent, Madhumita can relate to that.
There's such a taboo around these issues. You know, like a simple example would be growing up, I almost could never really openly say to my parents, oh, you know, I'm on my period. You know, I had to say things like, oh, I've got a stomachache. I'm not feeling very well today. And they would just understand that's just, you know, a hint for me being on my period. As a kid, nobody ever spoke to me about these things.
Part of reducing rape in India, she says, has to be tackling that taboo head on.
We have a long way to go with regards to sexual education, because these topics, you know, they're not discussed at home. They're also not discussed in schools. So there's literally no place for somebody growing up in India to get their information from these two legitimate institutions, you know, your family and your school.
With signs of that slowly changing, Madhumita says this is the time to talk openly about rape and to expand social research like hers throughout India.
We have to take baby steps. So just like I've started my work with prisoners in Delhi, there are people who've started work in other states with convicted rapists. And eventually, I really hope that there'll be a time where all of this data can be collaborated, can be consolidated, and when we're together able to find more and more answers. I think, want to contribute in some way to the ongoing efforts towards ending sexual violence in India.
Madhumita Pandey is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Criminology at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, England. She spoke with Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti. The final results from Madhumita's research with convicted rapists in New Delhi will be published this spring. This past October, Mexican journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto was in Washington receiving a Press Freedom Award from the National Press Club. Then last week, Gutierrez made another appearance in Washington, this time speaking through his attorney from an immigration detention center in Sierra Blanca, Texas.
Our life is dependent on this process. And I ask all of you, please do not leave us, do not abandon us.
Gutierrez sought asylum in the United States in 2008 with his son Oscar after his reporting led to death threats in Mexico. His case was denied earlier this year. Then last week, he was detained and is now on the verge of being deported. Kathy Kiley is a Press Freedom Fellow at the National Press Club Journalism Institute, a longtime political journalist, and now teaching at the University of New Hampshire.
He was writing about abuses of Mexican civilians by military forces. There have been a lot of allegations that the so-called war on drugs has been misdirected in some cases. As many of your listeners probably know, there are a lot of allegations of corruption in the Mexican government and belief that one of the reasons that the cartels have flourished is that law enforcement officials who are supposed to be pursuing them are in fact allied with them. And so Emilio was doing reporting on what he believed to be and what his stories alleged to be the abuse of law enforcement power in Chihuahua, Mexico.
Why is he being deported now? Why didn't a judge think that Emilio Gutierrez had a valid claim to stay in this country?
Well, that's a really excellent question. I think the thing that is important to emphasize here, and this is not the first case like this that we at the National Press Club have been focusing on. This is a Mexican journalist who did everything by the book. When he came into the United States, he did so openly. He didn't sneak across the border. He got a U.S. lawyer and requested asylum. He was detained for 9 months, during which time he was separated from his young son. Finally, he was paroled, which is what is supposed to happen when immigration authorities believe someone has a credible case. After that, he and his son lived in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where he did whatever he could to get by. He ran a food truck, he gardened. He has said he never believed that this would happen to him, but he has written about how much he missed doing journalism. but he was living there, and there was no action on his case until last summer when a judge finally did have a hearing on this case, and the judge subsequently decided that he did not feel that Emilio had a case. And you can read the ruling, we've got it up online, and it's, to me, remarkable that in a time when organizations running the gamut from Reporters Without Borders to the Committee to Protect Journalists to the United Nations, all of them are reporting that Mexico is the most dangerous place in the Western Hemisphere for journalists. Nonetheless, this El Paso-based immigration judge said he couldn't understand why Emilio needed protection, and that he, in fact, thought the Mexican military would be able to take care of him. So we just think the judge is wrong.
I should let listeners know that I'm a former member of the National Press Club myself. But Kathy Kiley, what's at stake here, in your view, with the decision of whether or not Emilio Gutierrez goes back to Mexico?
I think free speech. I think there's a transnational movement by powerful forces that don't want freedom of speech and that want power to run amok. And Emilio is the kind of journalist who is a check on that.
Kathy Kiley, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Back in June, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh joined us here on The Takeaway after fans at Fenway Park hurled racial insults at a black player.
We're asking companies to have conversations. We're asking churches to have conversations. We're asking neighborhoods to have conversations. Because when you think about what's happened in the country, whether it's been the acts of in Ferguson or New York, we need to do better as a society.
But that change that Marty Walsh was talking about is slow. All this week, the Boston Globe Spotlight team is looking into whether Boston's reputation for being an unwelcoming city for blacks is based in reality. You know Spotlight. They broke the story on sexual abuse and the cover-up in the Boston Archdiocese. For this series, Spotlight investigated the lack of diversity in the city's Seaport District, accessibility for blacks at elite Boston-area hospitals and colleges, and racism in sports. Today, they explore Boston's power brokers and whether African Americans are dealt into the city's steep political and economic hierarchy. Akilah Johnson is a reporter with the Spotlight team at the Boston Globe. She joins us from our partner station, WGBH, in Boston.
I mean, the reputation really goes back to the efforts to desegregate public schools in Boston from the 1970s. And just how vitriolic and just nasty and bitter that became. And it's been a reputation that the city has been fighting against since. And so there have been moments that have kind of flared up since then that reinforce, for lack of a better word, to the outside world that that reputation is still in play.
So, Akilah, in this installment of the series there at the Globe, you looked at political power, business power, really clout in Boston. What kinds of positions are we talking about? Just elected seats like Congress?
I mean, we're talking about elected officials, but we're also talking about, you know, partners at major law firms. We're talking about the business community. We're talking about the labor movement and labor unions in the city of Boston. Really, you know, the quarters of power that have influence and can pull the different levers to make things happen, put things in play, stop things from happening in the city of Boston.
You mentioned in the piece that Massachusetts has an 11-member delegation to Congress. All 11 members are white. You also mentioned that Boston has a string of 48 white male mayors in a row. 48.
Yes. So Boston has the distinction of being, of the 25 most populous kind of cities in the country, Boston has only elected white men as mayor. And there's only one other city that also has that distinction, and it's Indianapolis.
What does that distinction mean, do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, in a city of Boston, right, where you technically we are a majority-minority city, where communities of color, people of color, are over 50% of the population, it's rather telling that the city has only elected white men as mayor. It says something about access to power, sharing of power, distribution of power, coalition building. It speaks to a lot.
So what does all this mean for life in Boston? When you look at the mayor's office, when you look at the city council, when you look at the congressional delegation, or even the big business breakfast where you can count the black people on one hand, what does that mean for life in Boston and for the people who live there?
It points to several things, one of which is that the folks who are in positions of power and those who are representing the city are not reflective of the community in which they are representing. So there's a lack of overall representation, and that's just not an aesthetic thing. That's in terms of issues, nuance, connection, sensibilities. It also says for those African Americans and members of the black community who are able to break through, because they do break through, that it can be a rather isolating and lonely existence, and that overwhelmingly in college classrooms, in boardrooms, in the corridors of power, they're the only black person in that space. And that can be a large burden and weight on their shoulders.
The Spotlight team at the Boston Globe is busy with a series looking at the state of race in Boston and Boston's reputation for being an exclusionary city. Their latest installment is about political power in their city. Akilah Johnson is one of the reporters on that team. Akilah, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Here's some money. Go see a Star Wars.
Adventure? Excitement? Jedi craves not these things.
The Force is with us, but that's about it.
Dude, she's Vader.
No! She's the Emperor!
Jar Jar Binks makes the Ewoks look like chaff!
So it's on our training schedule for today. Lightsabers?
And they gon' bust up Vader's hood, the Death Star. Now what do you call that?
Intergalactic Civil War?
Gentrification!
This one is mine.
If anybody's anybody, I'm Han. And you're Chewbacca.
Chewie?
The Force is strong in that one.
Luke, I am your father.
Yes, everybody's heading to the theaters this weekend for The Last Jedi. Or you better be. I have my tickets already. I bought them a week ago. Rafer Guzman is here, film critic for Newsday. Rafer, great to have you.
Hi, Todd.
Been looking forward to this moment for a good long time. I'm glad you're here.
I'll bet you are.
We've got one other movie to look at besides The Last Jedi. We will get to that as well. Let's do some trivia first, some Star Wars trivia that I want you to answer. Your trivia question, Rafer: who shot first? Just kidding. That's not good. Don't answer that. Don't answer that. Here is your trivia question. Save this. If you know it, guys, hit me on Twitter. Rafer's going to answer this at the end of the segment. Luke loses his lightsaber at the end of Empire Strikes Back, Episode 5. How and where does he lose it? How does Luke lose his lightsaber? That's your question. If you know it, I know a lot of you know it, hit me on Twitter. We're going to The Last Jedi in a minute. We do have another film coming out this weekend. We can't pretend like the Star Wars universe extends to every single corner of our minds.
It does pretty much.
But let's talk about Call Me By Your Name. This is a new vehicle starring Armie Hammer, a piece that goes back to 1983 in Italy. Here's a clip.
She seems to like you a lot. She's more beautiful than she was last year. I saw her naked on a night swim once. Great body.
Trying to get me to like her?
What would be the harm in that?
Well, no harm. I just typically like to go those things on my own, if you don't mind.
Armie Hammer and his co-star in a beautiful landscape in Italy there.
Yes, indeed. This film actually came out a little while ago in November. It's expanding now, and this is a real hotly tipped Oscar favorite, I would say. Possible best picture and possible best actor for not Armie Hammer, but Timothée Chalamet,
yeah.
who plays a young kid in Italy. He's 17, falls in love with Armie Hammer's character, who's about 24, graduate student. Kind of funny, they're talking about a woman there, and I think sort of testing out each other's boundaries and each other's sexuality to see what's really happening there. Is this guy gay? Is he straight? What's really going on? Very erotic movie, and yet there's no actual sex depicted on screen. Kind of interesting. I like this movie a lot. It doesn't do what you kind of expect from a gay drama. I think with gay dramas, we expect a lot of coming out of the closet moments, a lot of moments of oppression, secretiveness, shame. You don't get that in this movie, which I think is kind of interesting, especially given that it's set in 1983. One thing I want to point out, Michael Stuhlbarg has a moment at the end of this film. He plays the boy's father. He delivers a speech that is so full of kindness and understanding and love that I feel like with that one short, maybe 90-second speech, he just might get an Oscar nomination for supporting actor.
That's Call Me By Your Name, which sounds like a film that's going to make its mark, especially when March and Oscar season comes around. Let's move on now, Rafer, to The Last Jedi. We don't have a clip because they don't put out clips.
That's right.
For Star Wars films. They're fairly secretive. I guess we're used to it by now, as frustrating as that is. Start us off. Now, when we left the story, Rey had gone to seek out Luke to get his advice, his wisdom, his warnings, apparently, on what's going on and what she might be facing as she confronts the dark side of the Force. So we're not going to traffic in spoilers, but how are we doing now?
Well, yes, as you remember, there was that last final scene in the first film in The Force Awakens. Huge moment for the audience, you know, big emotional impact, the face of Luke Skywalker back on screen. What Han Solo did in the first film, that sort of that serving as kind of connective tissue and kind of a central point in that film, Luke Skywalker is doing here. He is not a cameo. He is not a bit part. He is a major, major role in this film. Fans have been talking about the trailer, about how this is not going to go the way you think, famous line from the trailer. And I would say that's true. This is kind of not the Luke that we remember. You know, he's older, he's a little bitter. And again, I don't want to spoil too much, but he does have a dark kind of moment in this film. So again, everybody always wants to know what happens in this film until it's about to come out, and then nobody wants a spoiler. So I'm going to try to walk that line.
This is chapter two in the latest series here, so we're headed for a final chapter. I assume it leaves lots of questions unanswered, lots of twists and cliffhangers by the end.
Yeah, I think if I have a complaint about this movie, I feel that narratively, structurally, it's a little on the weak side. A lot of flip-flopping motivations. People change their minds a lot. I'm with you, I'm against you, I'm with you, I'm against you. I don't find that terribly convincing. But I will say one thing. Rian Johnson, new director. I don't know if you're a fan of his, but I am. Brick, Brothers Bloom, Looper. He really puts his stamp on this film in a way that I don't think other directors have been able to do with the Star Wars movie. This looks very stylish, very colorful. It's got a certain kind of visual flair to it that you don't usually see. I really like that about that, and I was happy to see that in a Star Wars film.
Well, you're with me, you're against me, you're with me. This is how I felt about Star Wars for years as they've pulled us in different directions. Look, I have tickets for 1 p.m. tomorrow. That's where I'll be. I've had them for a week. Let's go back to trivia, Rafer, before I let you go. I asked you how and where Luke loses his lightsaber in Empire Strikes Back.
All right, now, as for the how, is that not in the battle with Darth Vader?
It is.
Is that on the second Death Star?
That's in Cloud City on Bespin.
Okay.
Darth cuts his hand off. Luke returns the favor, by the way. Rafer Guzman, we're going to let you go. Rafer, what's your favorite Star Wars line of all time?
My favorite Star Wars line of all time, it's not in English, but I'll tell you what it is.
Please.
Uta Guta Solo? I don't know why that's my favorite line, but it is.
Going somewhere? Rafer Guzman, Newsday, thanks.
Thank you.
We have been hearing from all of you, so many of you, with your favorite Star Wars lines.
No, try not. Do or do not. There is no try.
Well, somebody had to save our skins. Into the garbage chute, flyboy.
That's impossible.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
You'll never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master.
If you only knew the power of the dark side.
Never tell me the odds.
You came in that thing? You're braver than I thought.
Commander, tear the ship apart until you find those plans and bring me the passengers. I want them alive.
Luke, I am your father.
Luke, I am your father.
Who's scruffy looking?
I'd just as soon kiss a Wookiee.
Oh, man. I love you guys. It's great. All of your voices, all of your favorite Star Wars lines. Here's mine. I got a little bit of time.
Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
Profound. Thank you, Master Yoda. And I'm looking forward to more of that. As I said, 1 p.m. on Saturday, I will be in my seat to watch The Last Jedi. Extremely excited. You're excited, too, from all corners of the galaxy. We love hearing from you on this 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always send your tweets to us at The Takeaway. And you can send your tweets to me, too. I always try to get back to you if you tweet me on the Twitters. at Todd Zwillick. Have a great time at the movies this weekend. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Miss you. I will.